From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, the case of missing American Robert Levinson draws scrutiny after the AP report he was in fact working for the CIA when he disappeared in Iran 7 years ago.
33 years of service to the United States deserves something. Please help me.
We look at why Republicans have triggered procedural delays ahead of the Christmas break, the African women calling on the US government to lift its ban on abortion for victims of rape in conflict zones, and we turn to North Korea after the country's second most powerful figure is executed.
We're definitely going to see some more people either purged, which would simply be relieved of their positions, executed outright, or they're heading for the border.
That's coming up on FSN Reports, after a summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Nina Maria Potts. South African officials say at least 100,000 people have visited the union buildings in the capital, Pretoria, where former President Nelson Mandela's body was lying in state for 3 days. Mr. Mandela's coffin was taken from the building shortly after the doors closed on the third day. He'll be buried at his ancestral home in the Eastern Cape on Sunday. His funeral will mark the end of an official 10-day period of mourning since the 95-year-old's death on December the 5th. The execution of the uncle of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has alarmed regional observers, who say there's an increased risk of instability in the nuclear-armed rogue state. After the purge and execution of Chung Sung-taek, who used to be a powerful force within the regime, there are fears now Pyongyang is sending a more sinister message to the rest of the world. UN investigators say they believe chemical weapons have been used at 5 locations in Syria. The findings of a 3-month mission suggest nerve agents were used against soldiers and civilians. Nick Harper reports from the United Nations in New York.
The final report for the United Nations inspection team is full of details, but not many definitive answers. Investigators visited 7 sites and believe chemical weapons were used at 5 of them. The report, however, says at 4 of the sites there was probable use or credible information that could not be independently verified. As expected, the report notes the significant time delay hampered their tests. Too much time had elapsed since the alleged uses for samples to prove conclusive. The only site where they could find what they called clear and convincing evidence was in Ghouta, the site of the August attack, which prompted calls for a thorough investigation after more than 1,200 people died. The report also does not say who carried out the attacks, as the mission was not tasked with apportioning blame. Nick Harper, New York.
The White House says it remains committed to bringing Robert Levinson home safely after he disappeared in Iran on Kish Island. Our Washington correspondent Priscilla Huff has more.
The White House refuses to comment on the relationship between Robert Levinson and the U.S. government. The Associated Press has revealed Mr. Levinson disappeared on Iran's Kish Island, a free trade zone, while investigating corruption on behalf of the CIA. In a statement, the family says it is time for the U.S. government to step up and take care of one of its own. And the White House says they regret the decision by the AP to run the story 3 years after the news agency learned of his ties to the CIA, saying publishing the story does nothing to bring him home, a goal the Obama administration remains committed to. Priscilla Huff, Washington.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. 18 gas pipeline workers, most of whom were Iranians, have been shot dead northeast of Baghdad. That's according to reports. The attack apparently happened near the city of Bakuba. Reports say several more people were wounded. Protesters in central Kiev have rebuilt barricades torn down by police who attempted and failed to clear protest camps. In the past 2 weeks, Ukraine has seen huge demonstrations after the president suddenly refused to sign a much-anticipated trade and reform deal with the European Union, infuriating many Ukrainians. Tom Barton reports.
As EU protesters reinforce their positions, Ukraine's deputy prime minister has echoed his president, saying Kiev will, after all, sign an association agreement with Brussels. The EU's foreign policy chief, Catherine Ashton, had flown to help peaceful negotiations and said President Viktor Yanukovych assured her he intended to sign. But demonstrators are expressing doubts about the sincerity of the government's words after Yanukovych earlier enraged them by backing away from the EU deal and turning towards Moscow. This after months of pressure from Russia, which banned various Ukrainian exports and stopped others at customs. Surveys show far more Ukrainians want a trade deal with the EU than with a rival Moscow-dominated customs union.
European Union countries should be ashamed of the amount of refugees from Syria they're offering to resettle, according to Amnesty. From London, Ollie Barrett reports.
Amnesty says 10 member states have only offered 12,000 places to Syrian refugees between them. It says the UK and Italy have not offered a single spot, with Germany making 80% of the pledges. Amnesty says the EU has miserably failed to offer safe havens to Syrians fleeing the war in their country, and criticises money spent on so-called pushback operations to stop Syrians travelling on from Turkey. The UK says its assistance is focused on the region and that it is one of the biggest international donors.
And that's the latest Feature Story News. Nina Maria Potts reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. Despicable human scum, worse than a dog. That's how North Korea's state-run news agency described Jang Song-taek, who Pyongyang claims was executed after being convicted of treason. Widely considered North Korea's second most powerful figure, the uncle of the country's young leader, Kim Jong-un, was accused of plotting a military coup. The execution would represent the most public purge of a top Pyongyang official for decades. FSN's Daniel Rinches spoke to Professor Stefan Haggard, director of the Korea-Pacific Program at the University of California.
Well, authoritarian regimes of this sort, when they move to purge people, are going to try to make a show of force. So what's going on in this statement is not directed only at what Jang did, but his followers or anyone else who may want to emulate him.
So the purge is not over?
Oh, by no means. We're definitely going to see some more people either purged, which would simply be relieved of their positions, executed outright, or they're heading for the border.
Is this the point where you say this is somebody who really knows the business of being a dictator?
Well, let me give on the other hand, answer to that question. On the one hand, he has to be able to command the forces to actually carry out the execution and the arrest. He has a piece of the military and security apparatus, which is basically following his commands. So in that sense, this demonstrates that he's in control. On the other hand, he's dependent exactly on those forces. So even though this is a leaderist system, it's one that's still very dependent on the military and security apparatus to maintain control.
In terms of the sort of family soap opera part of all this, what do you make of the fact that this is, and what do you make of the position now of his aunt, Kim Kyung-hee?
Well, her position has obviously been degraded as well. I doubt very seriously whether she's going to be able to maintain any independent status within the regime following her husband's purge. But this is just emblematic to me of the problems of succession that these sort of regimes face. The regent was put in place, Jang was put in place and put in positions of authority to guide Kim Jong-un. But in the course of doing that, of course, he himself accumulated power in a number of different domains. And then he also had a very important diplomatic role vis-a-vis China and oversaw some of the investment projects that the Chinese were doing. So on all these fronts, he had accumulated resources, both material and organizational, which were an indirect challenge to Kim Jong-un's authority.
And at what point does Kim Jong-un begin to assert his authority in this very brutal way, not only internally, but potentially externally in the region?
There are two ways to look at that. One is the question of whether he might actually launch a provocation to simply show that North Korea is not to be taken lightly or to be exploited during this time of internal disruption. My sense is that the moves that we've seen along the northern limit line in the Yellow Sea are probably more defensive in measure. They're designed simply to signal that this internal set of developments should not be exploited. So it's possible there could be a provocation, but I'm not really seeing any threats to the stability of the peninsula at this juncture.
What do you think Beijing is making of all this?
Well, I think the really interesting story to watch over the next week concerns this rumored defector who was an aide to Jiang's and got out of the country as long ago as September, October. I don't think the media has been paying adequate attention to this. If this guy has information on slush funds, on relations with the Chinese, perhaps even on the nuclear program, it's possible that we're looking at the wrong story and that it could actually be the defection of Jiang's aide that led to Jiang's downfall rather than the other way around.
Where is that aide right now?
We don't know even whether he exists. The South Korean government has denied the fact that this individual exists. This is a story which has been broken by several South Korean news organizations. But it would be quite natural for South Korea to deny his existence if his presence in China was controversial. But I think that this is going to be a big issue over the next week or 10 days. I'm sure that anyone who is an ally of Jiang is trying to get out of the country if they can, particularly those who are high up. And there are a handful of them that are already overseas. Now, they could be brought back because their families are held hostage, but it's possible we're going to see some other high-level defections over the next several weeks.
FSN's Daniel Rinch is speaking with Professor Stefan Hagar, Director of the Korea-Pacific Program at the University of California.
I need the help of the United States government to answer the requests of the group that has held me for 3.5 years. And please help me get home. 33 years of service to the United States deserves something. Please help me.
The voice of American Robert Levinson in 2011. Mr. Levinson, an ex-FBI agent, has been missing for 7 years, and while his whereabouts are unknown, it's thought he may be held hostage in Iran. But now a report by the Associated Press says he was in fact working for the CIA when he disappeared. Earlier, I discussed these latest revelations with Jason Ditz, a journalist with antiwar.com.
Robert Levinson was a former FBI employee who went missing in 2007 during a visit to Iran. Now, the State Department at the time said that he was a private businessman in Iran on private business, and that's been their stance ever since. The Associated Press revealed yesterday that they've been withholding a story for 3 years that shows he was actually an employee of the CIA at the time, and that he was in Iran on official CIA business, albeit somewhat in violation of the department within the CIA that he was working in's mandate.
This hostage situation wasn't as black and white as we thought, according to the report from the AP. Within that report, it's also alleged that Mr. Levinson's family was paid some $2.5 million.
Levinson had a contract with the CIA for about $80,000 for his previous work. That had just expired when he was on his way to Iran, and they were in the process of negotiating a new contract for $120,000. The CIA gave the $120,000 to his family, and they also gave them a $2.5 million tax-free annuity in return for a promise not to sue over his disappearance.
In terms of the story and his whereabouts, is it any clearer? Because there have been mixed signals from the State Department.
Right. It's really not clear at all where he is. The administration has mostly played up the idea that he's in Iran, that he's being held by the Iranian government. Secretary of State Clinton at the in 2011 said that they believe he's somewhere in southwestern Asia, which really covers everything from Israel to Afghanistan. So there's a pretty broad spectrum of countries that he could be in. And we really don't know for sure.
In your opinion, was this a story that needed to be told at this point? I mean, the U.S. government strongly urged Associated Press not to run the story because they thought it would potentially endanger the life of Robert Levinson and wouldn't actually do anything to further the cause of bringing him home. Do you agree with that?
I think the story probably should have been told quite some time ago. The reality is we don't even know who has him. We don't know what their agenda is. They haven't issued any real demands. It's not clear at all what they want. So withholding this story about him working for the CIA, I don't think necessarily puts him in any additional danger. If anything, it probably makes it more likely that whoever has him is going to publicize that fact.
Jason Ditz from antiwar.com. Now, the U.S. Senate held rare back-to-back all-night sessions this week after Republicans triggered procedural delays on the president's nominees for several major agencies and federal courts. Some lawmakers said they did this in protest over the Democratic majority's decision to strip them of their right to filibuster nominees and over the nominees themselves, especially two progressive women who will now sit on the second highest court in the country. On Capitol Hill, Alice Ulstein has more.
When a majority of senators voted in November to make a major change to the chamber's rules for confirming executive nominees, they expressed hope that it would make things more efficient. Breaking the gridlock on dozens of President Obama's nominees, whose confirmations were held up for months. But if this week is any indication, there may not be smooth sailing ahead.
I think that we will use parliamentary procedures where we think it's in our interest to do so.
That's Arizona Republican John McCain explaining why his party kept the Senate in session all night Wednesday and Thursday, forcing lawmakers, their staff, and the Capitol security guards to pull back-to-back all-nighters. The parliamentary procedures he mentioned include making the Senate clerk read long bills and amendments in their entirety, refusing to agree by voice vote to waive 30-plus hours of debate, and refusing to let any committees hold hearings while the Senate is in session. Tennessee Republican Bob Corker said these tactics were done in retaliation for Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid's decision to trigger the so-called nuclear option, which allows a simple majority to confirm nominees.
I think at the end of the day, you know, there has to be, when you disrespect the body, as he did, when you overrule your own parliamentarian with 51 votes, 52 votes in this case, when you basically decide that there are no rules in the Senate, because that's in essence what he and others who joined him did, I think there has to be some reaction. If there's not some degree of pushback, people that don't want to go through the effort of actually leading, they just want to take shortcuts, will continue to take shortcuts.
But other Republican lawmakers said the delay tactics were also in protest of the nominees themselves, including two women confirmed this week to sit on the D.C. Circuit Court, which has had vacant seats for nearly a decade. During the late-night debate on their confirmation, Iowa Republican Chuck Grassley called Nina Pillard and Patricia Millett committed ideologues, while Alabama Republican Richard Shelby told FSN on Friday that the nominees would make the court more liberal.
The stacking of the court is a very bad thing, I think. The court's underused now. They want to stack it to change the configuration. That's not good. That's raw politics. We're against that.
But many Democratic lawmakers and legal experts, including Marge Baker with People for the American Way, defended the record of the new judges, especially Nina Pillard.
She wrote the briefs in the case that successfully ended the Virginia Military Institute's male-only policy. And then she also successfully litigated a case that upheld the Family and Medical Leave Act, two very, very important cases for women's rights. So there were attempts to make her into some sort of radical feminist, basically because she argued for women's equality. She argued that if you're going to have any programs that are dealing with absence-only policy, you needed to make sure that they weren't stereotyping women and making it the responsibility entirely a woman's responsibility around abstinence.
The Senate also confirmed longtime Democratic Congressmember Mel Watt to lead the Federal Housing Finance Agency and Deborah Lee James to lead the Air Force. While many of these confirmed agency leaders will likely be replaced by the next president, the judges confirmed to the powerful D.C. Circuit Court could serve for many decades, weighing in on the president's policies and shaping the law of the land. More votes are scheduled over the weekend. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
Since the tragic shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Connecticut last December, many U.S. school districts have increased their security budgets. They've beefed up safety procedures and invested in new equipment, making school security a growth industry. Meanwhile, the state of Colorado has been on the cutting edge of school security since the 1999 Columbine High School shooting. FSN's Denver correspondent Mary McCarthy sent us this report about the latest security innovations there.
This is a simulated active shooter situation, acted out by professionals, high school students, and real police officers. They're working with TI Training, a company based in Golden, Colorado, to make a film that will be used to train school principals and security officers around the U.S. The exercise is led by John McDonald, Executive Director of Security at Jefferson County Public Schools.
It's important that we continue to up our training. It's important that we continue to look at what the evolution of school safety is.
Jefferson County has a painful history. It's where the Columbine shooting happened, and that's not all.
We've unfortunately have had 4 school shootings in a 35-mile radius, and that's tough, and that's in a 12-year period of time.
Jefferson County has an annual security budget of $2 million, plus a team of full-time school police officers paid for by the sheriff's office. It's a big budget, and Blake Kozak, a senior analyst at IHS, says it's typical of what schools around the U.S. are spending on security, especially in the wake of last year's elementary school shooting in Connecticut.
This year we're in now 2013. The market size for security, specifically security equipment within education, is worth about $630 million, and we're expecting this to increase by about 14% to about $720 million by 2014.
And that growth is forecast to continue. School security is predicted to become a nearly $5 billion a year industry by 2017. Much of that money is used to buy surveillance cameras, which are increasingly sophisticated.
The trend for schools is really to have first responders as well as police and faculty be able to view an event in real time and be able to react prior to even arriving on scene because they know exactly what is occurring.
It's about having the best equipment and also the best training, says Tyler Garn of TI Training.
In the past, it's just been more about we train our staff. Law enforcement trains how they train. But getting them together and putting them through the same kind of training is a pretty new idea.
Experts say the best school security policies also effectively communicate with students and parents, reassuring them that despite the headlines about high-profile shootings, schools are generally very safe. In Denver, I'm Mary McCarthy.
This is FSN Reports. African women rights activists are calling on the US government to lift its ban on abortion services for rape victims in conflict zones. US aid policy in Africa is coming under fresh scrutiny because of legal restrictions outlawing funding for abortions. Healthcare facilities in Africa that receive US government funds treat women only after they're already suffering or dying from botched abortions. From Washington, Nina Maria Potts reports.
Human rights activists say 48 women between the ages of 15 and 49 are raped every hour in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Yet the right to a safe abortion, should they fall pregnant, is denied. And even in countries where abortion is legal, a US ban on funding the controversial practice means rape victims are turned away, unless they're already suffering from an abortion gone wrong. Sarah Sippel is president of the Center for Health and Gender Equality.
We really need action taken immediately to make sure that these women are getting the care and the response they need after they've been raped.
The U.S. ban on providing abortion services to rape victims abroad isn't the only problem. Human rights activists accuse the international community of failing to bring the perpetrators of sexual violence to justice. Liesl Gandholtz is with Human Rights Watch.
I think women in Africa say that the real issue is impunity and access to services because both are equally important. And where we've seen some advances being made, certainly at a policy level around impunity, we haven't seen similar progress being made around access to services.
For the victims of rape and their families, the trauma of sexual attacks often makes it impossible to move on, which is why a group of African women was in Washington this week to call on President Obama to intervene. Justine Masika-Bihamba's family was targeted by soldiers in the DRC, who invaded her home and sexually assaulted her daughter. She says there's no hope now of healing.
Mes enfants sont traumatisés.
My children are really traumatized, especially the youngest one. He can't go near a soldier or a member of the military.
For others, the blame lies at the door of the U.S. government. A decades-old provision, known as the Helms Amendment, forbids the U.S. to pay for abortion as a method of family planning. Although it does not prohibit U.S. foreign aid in cases of rape, incest, or life endangerment, it's been almost politically impossible for successive administrations to make that distinction. Ruth Ojiambo Ocheng heads up an NGO in Uganda called the Women's International Cross-Cultural Exchange. She says it's not uncommon for African rape victims who may be pregnant to walk tens of miles to the nearest American-funded healthcare clinic and be turned away.
We would like the Obama administration to separate family planning from services for rape victims who have become pregnant.
Rights activists insist that getting President Obama to issue an executive order to do more for the health of rape victims would not require an act of Congress. But they say if this administration really cares about development in Africa, it needs to start putting women at the heart of its aid policy. Nina Mrepots, Washington.
This is FSN Reports. And finally, with only a week left until Congress goes on Christmas vacation, the House Science Committee held a two-hour meeting on the existence of life on other planets.
This is a subject rich in history and promise, and one that fascinates the American public. During my time as NASA chief historian, everywhere I went, people wanted to know about life on other worlds, and they still do.
Perhaps not the most pressing issue on the congressional to-do list, but nevertheless, the two-hour session tackled the big questions of the universe and stressed that astrobiology is about more than the existence of little green men.
For thousands of years, humans have looked up at the stars and wonder whether life exists beyond our home planet. This curiosity was renewed with the latest discoveries by NASA's Kepler mission, totaling 3,500 new candidate planets outside our solar system. With Kepler's help, more than 800 potential worlds have now been confirmed, orbiting stars other than our sun. And at least five of these are Earth-sized and orbiting within the habitable zone of each of their stars. This reminds us just how important NASA's work is to the understanding of the universe and the potential for life beyond our solar system.
Astrobiologists from NASA, MIT, and the Library of Congress attended, but no doubt the search for intelligent life in Congress will continue after the Christmas break. And that's the Friday edition of FSN Reports. You can tell us what you think of the show. Email us. We're there at reports@featurestory.com. That's reports@featurestory.com. Follow us on Twitter. We're there at Feature Story. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Simon Marks and Nina Maria Potts on the bulletin desk. For everyone with Feature Story news everywhere, have a great weekend. Goodbye.